Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, everyone. Welcome along to this week's group chat. Gavin is here. Richard is here. Zara is here.
Hello.
How are we all?
How are you?
Long Tuesday. Very long Tuesday.
No, it's because yesterday was so long.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, long Tuesday.
That Tuesday,
if we are a little de-energized today, it's because Tuesday was long. I had a long day in Leinster House. Richard, you had a long day at Orson O'Thron.
Following a long weekend at the Ardèche and whatnot
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
It just feels like it's been like
a long couple of weeks.
But also it's one of those ones where like not a huge amount unexpected actually happened.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of formalities to these days. And there's also huge long waits in the middle of them as well.
And also, often it can be very tiring if you think that there's going to be a lot of ministerial moving and shaking and reshuffling, and then when it turns out not to be, it kind of just feels like it drains a lot of the energy out of you.
The non-shuffle.
Even before we get to that, actually, let's go back to the weekend, to the Fine Gael Ardèche in Galway, where you were on duty and talking to Simon Harris as he set out some of his stall for what he wants to achieve. And it was very notable that, in a way, he kind of immediately repudiated the government's targets on housing by immediately setting this target that many people wonder how you could possibly meet.
Yes, I think that's interesting that if somebody who's been in cabinet now for 8 years, Simon Harris, as part of the 13 years that Fine Gael has been in government, that he has, you know, obviously he acknowledges that housing is the biggest issue, and it has been the biggest issue facing this country for multiples of years now. So his big plan to end housing, and he's putting this forward as somebody who says, I can relate to people of my generation, people in their 30s, people in their 20s, who can't dream at this point of owning their own home. What he said he wants to do is he wants to extend or expand rather the renter's tax credit over €1,000. That's tinkering around the edges. It's something which would be, you know, beneficial, but it's not a huge change. The one big change, though, that he did put forward was he believes that Fine Gael, if it is re-elected into the next government, that it wants to and can realistically achieve a goal of building 250,000 new homes over the next 5 years. Now, the Department of Housing says, if let's do the simple maths on it. Simple maths of it is, you think you'd split those out, 50,000 houses each year for the next 5 years. Mm. He says not so, because the Department of Housing says it's absolutely impossible to build 50,000 new homes this year and next year. So what he thinks is, well, if Fine Gael is re-elected, the next government will go and it'll be like sort of like 30-something thousand houses,
30-something. 40, 50,
and then
60,
it's all
70.
Backloaded, yeah. So that's what he said.
But he still thinks that it's possible that in like 5 years' time you could be building 70,000 homes a year.
Yep. That's what he says. And this is what we sort of challenged him about over the weekend. A lot of people are pulling this out as this is pie in the sky stuff.
They think it's totally unrealistic or something.
Yeah, and he also did say that, I mean, he was effectively calling the government's own targets, the government he's been part of for multiple years, completely unambitious, effectively. That if you're only, you know, what was the new build figure in total for last year? It exceeded its overall target for overall total homes.
So in the low 30,000.
Yeah, low 30s, might be 32, 33.
Affordable. Yeah.
Yes, so like there's a huge hill of a difference between 30-odd thousand to pushing up to 70-odd thousand by the back end of
it. There'll be people who say that you're never going to get it unless you at least try to be ambitious.
And I
that you have to
that,
set
yeah.
a target that if you don't strive to build 70,000 homes in 5 years' time, you're never going to do it. But there's still the question mark and this idea of like moving mountains and moving heaven and earth and being the person that gets the adult child out of the box room and into a house of their own. And it just all feels like it's stuff that they could have been doing up till now, Zara.
Well, yeah, better late than never, I suppose. Like, do you know what? We'd always be the first ones to criticise them, but I'm going to go ahead and say I welcome an ambitious plan. They might be
Where
setting themselves up for failure,
Where
but
he?
I welcome an ambitious plan.
Like, I mean,
he was in higher education and health, I suppose. Maybe he felt it wasn't, I don't know. Like,
well, actually, Leo Varadkar himself, actually, is one of the interesting points. If we get past the personalities and whatnot, Leo Varadkar in his farewell speech to the Dáil was saying the one thing he regretted from his time in office was excessive caution. Mm-hmm. And that he felt that, you know, in the aftermath of the pandemic, in the aftermath of Brexit, that maybe we were all a bit too cautious in terms of government and the projections for how much money would be in the economy, that they could have ramped up these plans earlier. So he admitted basically the government got it wrong in terms of on housing and the initiatives that they tried to put out there to build new homes and to try and get people into houses as opposed to what's happening now. Mm. So, I mean, that admission is interesting. That is a very Leo Varadkar frank admission, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't cover any, you know, pain for the people who have been suffering the impact of the housing crisis for so long.
Yeah, and in truth, we only know for certain that he can be Taoiseach for the next 10 months or so, and then he has to call a general election, and who knows what's going to happen after next February, if even they get that far.
So if you were to be cynical, you would say it's easy to set ambitious targets when you don't have to actually be the person to deliver them.
In a way, it's a case of, even if you set the targets now, the targets then become your general election platform for next time around. Okay. Because there's always, like he was talking about...
Then you could argue, if you're a voter, like, why should I believe you? As you say,
well, look at the track record, and everybody will point this out, the track record of promises through, you know, over a decade of Fine Gael in power. Children's Hospital, you have multiple promises around, you know, delivery of different grants and the amount of houses which have to be built. There
scoliosis
is a litany.
Treatments.
Scoliosis waiting lists, absolutely massive promises which were not delivered on. Now, they will point to various different things which caused them to not be able to fulfill these promises. But it is hard to convince a very, very tired public that you're the man and you're the party to fix all of this when you have been behind 13 years of, you know, people seeing different promises not kept. Mm.
I have a take.
Go on.
Have a take.
Go on.
And I've been thinking about this since yesterday, right?
So
this is more to do with the kind of the coronation ceremony or whatever you want to call it yesterday in the Dáil, right?
We'll get to that in a second, right?
So, you know, you were talking there about Richard all the time that Simon Harris has been there. So Simon Harris was, what, 24 when he went into the Dáil?
He was 24 when he became a minister, I think 22.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry, no.
No, he was 24, wasn't
he? Yeah, sorry, yeah, beg your pardon. Yeah. Yes, so 13 years, yes.
So yesterday was, you know, big day for Simon Harris on a personal level. Family and friends are all there. I just was a bit aghast by the, I'm going to say, I feel almost like Simon Harris is slightly infantilized by his colleagues at times in a way that is like really bizarre to me. Like, I do not understand. Like, Heather Humphrey stands up and she proposes him and says, oh, when I first saw Simon Harris, I presumed he was a fella on a school tour coming in here. Mm. Like, the day the man is becoming the head of the country is not the time to make that joke.
Yes, somebody observed to me yesterday. Somebody observed to me yesterday that there's a Fine Gael tradition that when the Taoiseach is being nominated, that their proposal is put forward by the youngest member of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party. And in this instance, they couldn't do it
because
Simon Harris is himself the youngest member of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party.
So you had that joke, and then there was somebody else made a remark as well about Simon Harris being really young, and kind of like, I feel like every step of the way yesterday we just kind of kept being reminded of how young this person is and how, like, you know, the kid is running the shop almost. And I just thought it was a really bizarre tone to set, and it kind of reminded me of, like, you know, he's been there for what, 14 years so in total.
Yeah,
it's like when you leave college and you go into your first job and you stay working in the same office, you're always treated as like the youngest person in the office, and you never get the kind of, you never get the respect really that you deserve as a senior person. And now Simon Harris is the Taoiseach, he's head of government, and, you know, this kind of constant making of him being really young is not great. It's not great. Yeah, the TikTok thing is fine. I'm not so bothered by the TikTok thing, I think it ties into it.
It's like, oh, he's this.
I actually think
whisperer.
It discredits Simon Harris in a way that he probably doesn't deserve, actually.
Do you think that maybe some of the criticism, if there is criticism,
and it's a little
of his
ageist,
age,
I'm going to say, well, as well.
Is it because he basically has spent his entire adult life working in politics and never kind of had a job in the...
He's the young lad who went into the office and stayed in the same job for the last 14 years, and has risen through the ranks and is now in a position that deserves a bit more credit than, you know, than slagging off his age.
But despite his undoubted authority and his obvious experience in managing public affairs, irrespective of whether people think he's any good or not, do you think he's that some of that ageism is because he's a career politician who has never worked a day in the real world and doesn't know what it's like on an average salary?
Possibly,
maybe.
But I still think, what do you make of it? I think he has, I think it is a little bit...
Well, they all think he's the best person with the job. They all nominated him for Taoiseach. So I don't think there's any... Like, I get it. I get the whole, like...
I think the narrative is just a bit...
But I frankly don't care, because I think that at this point in time, with all of the problems which are facing the government, I don't give a crap about personalities anymore. There's been so much talk, and we've rightly talked about who's going to be sitting around the cabinet table. There's so many people who are waiting for a home. There's so many kids who are waiting for scoliosis.
I agree with you, but I think it matters more than you think it does. I think people need to have confidence in the person at the top.
But these people have all nominated for him. They say that he's going to be a great leader.
Yeah, but then they've gone and made a joke about how they thought he was on his school tour.
Yeah, back 11 years ago. I don't personally think it matters a lot. I can absolutely see your point on it. But I just think that at this point in time, people have seen Simon Harris be around cabinet for a long, long time. He's one of the longest serving Fine Gael ministers of all time, having served 8 years.
Yeah, I agree with you.
He has seniority. He has a huge amount of seniority. Yeah. He's a literal Taoiseach at this point in time. Like, Leo Varadkar was only a year older than him. People like, oh, actually, I remember people making jokes about Leo Varadkar's age in the same way they did about Simon Harris.
I think
actually.
It's different. I don't know. Yeah. I think it's different.
I just think that at this point in time, it's all about serious action now at this point in time, because we've had 3 weeks of the whole furore and the whirlwind around politics.
The jamboree.
Well, there's serious things that are going to happen in terms of what actually is going to change now, because that's like what exactly is going to change. He's been part of the programme for government that has been set out under this coalition. Mm. He has a max of 12 months to do anything. What has he told us he's going to do? The first couple of things he's told us he's going to do is effectively park the hate speech bill, because he wants to have another look at that. That's something which he'd previously sought to push through when he was the stand-in minister for justice.
So they're committed to doing it, but just at some other stage, not necessarily now.
Don't know where they're going to find the time for this in the 11 months. So that's something to keep an eye on. The other thing he's going to put a pause on, because he wants to have a look at, is the late licensing laws, because of the concerns expressed by the Road Safety Authority. Now, that's a huge, huge issue which is growing here in this country. That is the amount of road deaths we've had. He says he wants to make that a priority. Again, I don't know what you can do in 12 months, but something really does need to be done in terms of what we're seeing in the roads across the country.
Well, we talk about it being 12 months there, but in truth, when you're looking at the stuff that you can legislate for, in truth, it's far less than that. Because if they go the full distance and they dissolve in early February when they have to, there's only, I think, 2 dull sitting weeks after Christmas. You're going to get nothing done in the last 2 weeks when everyone is looking down the barrel of an election. Mm. After the budget, there's a lot of legislating you have to do for the budget. But basically, Christmas is your deadline, and there's also like 6 or 8 weeks when you're gone during the summer. So realistically, he's got 8 months minus the summer recess. Yeah.
So how many working weeks is that in total?
I think there might be about like 20-odd like parliamentary sitting weeks between now and Christmas, and that's basically all the time he's got to do stuff, which is an interesting point given the criticism that there's been this week about the Dáil actually not having much of an opportunity to do that. Now, here's a little bit actually for people who didn't catch it of Richard Boyd Barrett criticising the shelving of some Dáil business this week.
It's just not acceptable. And I think just because we're having this jamboree today is not a reason to take business off the agenda, which is of extreme importance to ordinary people in this country.
Deputy, it's not appropriate to describe the election of a Taoiseach as a jamboree. Let's have a guard and respect for our constitution and for the role that we play here.
Richard Boyd Barrett getting scolded there by the Count Corolla, but largely because he was complaining that the constitutional moving of chairs and the business of electing a new Taoiseach and appointing new members to government all meant that a lot of valuable Dáil time, where a lot of other business could have been done this week, wasn't getting done. And much as he was scolded for raising the point in the wording that he did, got a bit of a point.
Yeah, I mean, it is a valid point. And some of the things that were kind of moved on off the agenda, you know, pushed back, are really important matters. And actually, I suppose, optically, when you're going into like your first day in the job, you know, first day as Taoiseach, there probably, you know, arguably could have been a sitting. You know, even the cabinet meeting, for example, was it last night in the Oris, you were in the Oris, Richard.
Yep.
You know, maybe there could have been a bit more work done at that and, you know, not necessarily needing another cabinet meeting then subsequently this afternoon.
Well, today's cabinet meeting, the Wednesday, the day we're recording this, the cabinet meeting got underway at 11 and was finished just after 12 because they had their photo op, or 12 and just after one because they had their photo call with all the new junior ministers. Richard, you were around last night for their ceremonial sitting, which was ceremonial at best.
Yeah, it's 15, 20 minutes of a job. Then, of course, what an hour then today, if not more. Like, if you're trying to set out the message that
we're
you want to hit the ground running, we have limited time to make a difference to the lives of the people of this country. You're taking 2 cabinet meetings to do it. And I've been in many longer meetings than an hour and a quarter. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
If you take 2 of them to do that.
I just think that maybe they should have, like, if the one of the big criticisms of Simon Harris on the personality-wise is that it's all image, and it's all how things are perceived. Well, if image and all that is so important, I think you'd have made a bigger focus of getting a big meeting done early. I wouldn't have made that ceremonial one last night. If you're only going to do 15 minutes, don't do it at all. Make it a bumper cabinet meeting. Really focus on the objectives of each department. Bang heads together and say, look, we have limited time here. The polls show politically that we're underwater. We have a chance of being re-elected. We can do something here if we really like grab some initiative.
And then get back in and do a leader's questions today.
Well, that's the point. I think people might be watching this now on a Wednesday night or listening to it on a Thursday morning and wondering that they're thinking they haven't actually seen or heard much of Simon Harris since he got the gig. And the usual marquee thing when you are a new Taoiseach, there's the whole high profile bit in the Dáil of doing leader's questions. And whatever about the questions that come afterwards where you need to be slightly better over the internal workings of your department, you'd think leader's questions where you're kind of setting out your stall or dealing with big affairs of state, you'd think that's a thing that a new Taoiseach ought to be able to do on day one in the job and not need to take the day off because you're not sure whether you're fully briefed enough or capable of answering these questions. Like if you are the Taoiseach and you've now been entrusted with the power of the office, are you not also capable of being held to account in the Dáil Chamber for at least half an hour's worth? He is going to be going to Brussels and Warsaw on Thursday of this week. He's got meetings with Ursula von der Leyen and then with Charles Michel. So he's doing the full European gamut. There's talk of a meeting soon with Rishi Sunak as well to talk about affairs northern. Mm-hmm. And there, no doubt there'll be a big work agenda. But I think for someone, if he is so supposedly conscious about image, you think he'd want to give the image of actually being in the chamber and getting down to work. Now, jumping off from that discussion we were just having about how the government might be able to move the needle a little bit on housing, we have someone in studio who has been through the house buying process of late. James Cavanagh, star of the great Inspo Home Adventure, Sunday nights in Virgin Media One. Thanks so much for dropping in to see us. How's the house hunt going?
It's going in the middle of it. But to be honest, doing the house show was great because we went into this process like I wanted the country fantasy. I wanted like 10 acres, horses running through a big rambling house. But from seeing loads of different types of houses, I'm like robbing little bits of inspo here and there, which is the whole point of the show. Yeah. And we've kind of realised we don't need like 10 acres or a big rambling manor. It's more about the kind of the feeling you get when you go to see a house and the footprint of the house that it's on. Does it have nice trees and a mature garden, which is something we wanted. So our list went from there to there, which was driven really by budget, but also by not needing certain things or whatever. But yeah, we're nearing the end.
How did you find the whole process from the get-go till now? Like insightful, exciting, inspirational, stressful, all of the above?
The show itself was great. I love snooping around people's houses. So, you know,
I love when you would say to them, can I have a snoop around your house?
Oh my God. Every time the director was like, you need to say a different word for snoop.
Snoop around house. That'd be a great supercut afterwards of all the snooping.
Snoop. Yeah. So yeah, that was great to kind of, as I said, get inspiration and see the kind of houses we actually were zoning towards of what we wanted. But I found the whole thing pretty stressful, like the going to the bank, the sheer amount of forms you have to fill out. I don't know how people do it without a broker. We had a broker and they do the heavy lifting, but some people do it without one and there's just so many forms and I'm not the best at admin on the best of days. So yeah, it was stressful and fun at the same time.
And it was interesting. So you guys were really open about the process and the mortgage application. And then your partner was newly self-employed. So it made more sense for you guys to go with the mortgage with just you on it for the time being. Just talk us through that whole process and then realizing that your budget might be a bit more like a bit less than you expected it would be.
Yeah, I went into this very juvenile. I thought you could go to the bank and ask for as much as you wanted. And it's just you work out a payment, repayment plan. But it's only, you know, three times your wage and all that sort of stuff. So it gets smaller. The reality gets a bit smaller. I earn money. It sounds really dodgy what I'm saying. I earn money in a weird way.
I'm not a baron.
Very official, yeah.
You are a tax-paying freelancer.
I'm a tax-paying freelancer. And William's the same. He works in restaurants. He also caters a bit. He does art. He sells his prints. So, we make money and we pay our way and we pay our rent and taxes and all that. But to a bank, we're a bit of a nightmare. And it's the same for anyone who's a kind of freelancy thing. It's hard to pitch yourself to a bank. So it turned out that actually William was a bit of a liability and it would just be me going on the mortgage. So I'm basically a single person getting the mortgage. We were able to access around 350, 360. So I'm completely priced out of Dublin totally.
Which is where I grew up.
Yeah, I'm from Churchtown. And I was just saying before this, I'm lucky that I want to live in the country. I'm lucky that I want to live outside Dublin because I cannot afford a house in Dublin. And the things I want are a garden. You know, I'd like a garden, a front garden, a bit of a drive. These are like considered luxuries now. Like,
which is crazy.
Who do you think you are asking for a garden?
Mad. And I have friends who are buying small enough houses around Dublin, which are pushing 650, 700. And it's almost like the houses that my friends are getting now are like the council house I grew up in Churchtown. We're being priced outside Dublin completely, but I actually want to live down the country, so thank God.
But it does open your eyes, I suppose, to the situation for people who do want to stay in Dublin or because of work they need to be in Dublin. So people who are in similar situations who are looking to live in Dublin where their work is, it just shows, you know, the lack of affordability, the lack of options that are there.
Yeah, like all of my friends, I'm 34 now, most of my friends are around that age bracket. They're anyone who's trying to get a house is living at home at the moment. Mm-hmm. No one can afford no way can you afford to rent and save for a house. So most of my friends are back living with their parents now, which I couldn't imagine.
Well, it's really challenging. And we talk about even extended periods of adolescence that comes with that, don't they? Because, you know, you've got your parents who are thinking, what time will you be home at? And are you going to have dinner? Will we do a plate for you? You know, it's those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting because your partner's from Cork, from Currabinnie, yeah, and East Cork. And, you know, you guys sort of would have liked that idea of being close to the family in East Cork. But in the last episode of the show, you just had to accept that you were actually priced out of Cork.
Yeah.
That it was just too expensive.
And again, I was a bit naive. I was like, oh, going down the country, I can afford anywhere. But like, it's not the case. There's areas of Cork which are just as expensive as Dublin. And William, my boyfriend, he grew up by the sea. So he was like, always wanted to live by the sea. That's just not an option. That adds another whack onto the price.
Yeah.
So yeah, we kind of have realized now we can't go to Cork. So we're looking elsewhere. The other good thing about the show is we visited pretty much every county almost in Ireland. So I've realized actually there's so many areas that I would love to live. So yeah, we've opened our geographical eyes to living somewhere else.
Just rewinding back a couple of minutes to when you said you were applying for the mortgage and how it ended up just being your salary alone because of William's employment status kind of being seen by banks as being a bit precarious, even if it is perfectly stable and if he's able to make his own way. How do you feel about that idea of the amount that you can borrow being like so explicitly linked to the amount that you're earning? Because there's some people who'd say it's only right to do that because it stops you borrowing loads more than you might be able to afford and stops you paying over the top for an amount you don't need. Yeah. But there's other people who'd say, well, you know, if you're capable of working out a payment plan where you could be able to borrow 100,000 or 200,000 more and get a house that's closer to where you grew up, to where all your community is, to where all your friends are, that should be open to people, but it's not.
I think it completely needs to be increased because at the moment, the amount you can get isn't equal to the house prices. Like, it's just not. And so I think, you know, I talking to my parents when they went to the banks. Now, I think the interest rate was like kind of crazy, the payment thing back or whatever.
But so was inflation. So it was all relative, really. Yeah.
Yeah, but they could access a lot more from the banks. So they were able to buy these houses that we just can't now. But it doesn't make sense, especially I don't know how single people are doing it or, you know, people who are
single people who are renting, for example. That's something which a lot of people in our age demographic are going through at the moment. Really, really hard to build up savings to get that deposit to get into the mortgage situation if you are living alone and you're paying Dublin or Cork or Galway rents at this point. So that is a really tough one.
Yeah. And I don't think your rent is even really taken into consideration, your repayments. Like my rent is more expensive than my mortgage repayments now.
Yeah, that's the problem.
My mortgage repayment will be a good couple of hundred euro cheaper than what my rent is at the moment. But I couldn't get a mortgage for, say, the house that I live in now, even though I can actually pay it back. So to answer your question, I think we need to be able to access a bit more money.
What do you hear from your friends who are living at home, James? You know, do they feel optimistic? Do they feel positive? I suppose in a way they're probably lucky if they have parents living in Dublin that they can work and live in the capital city. But how do they feel about the future and what their next steps will be?
They're quite shook, to be honest. And I'm the only one out of my friend group really who wants to live down the country. I need chickens and a vegetable patch. That's kind of my new era.
Can't begrudge a man his chickens, you know.
Yeah.
My cousin recently got chickens and yesterday she put a really funny post on Instagram. It only laid one egg. She was like, girls, are you on strike or what?
I expect 12 eggs a day. Chicken.
What the hell? Like, nothing going.
Yeah. No, but they're not. They're really upset. And my friend went to view a house yesterday and there was like 15 other couples. Like the estate agent told them literally within the 2 hours. And the bidding thing is another spooky
thing. Yeah,
tell
us about the bidding wars that you found yourself in.
Yeah, I hear that estate agents will put, say, an asking price of 350 onto the house, but the house they know will actually get about 450. And I find that mad that it can go like as high, but they do that. They price it low so they get loads of attention and they can create a bit of a bidding war. But I hear there's actually caps on that in other countries in Europe. It can only go an extra certain percent over the asking price. But here it's a free-for-all.
Yeah,
it can go as much. So the bidding was a bit spooky for me because you're bidding with five anonymous people and it's like a game. It's like you're I don't know, online gambling.
Do you ever have any suspicion in the middle of all of that that all the other bidders did actually exist? Because I remember when we were buying our house 10 years ago and we ended up like in a bidding war where we were getting like texts from an estate agent every 15 or 20 minutes saying, oh, the other side has just gone another 5 or 10,000 up. And you were getting to the point where you weren't actually sure these other people existed at all.
Well,
and was the estate agent just capitalising because they knew you were desperate?
Well, for I was bidding on a house and I didn't have to prove to the bidding system that I had the money. So I'm like, there, other people could have been. And I'm like, if I was selling a house, I might just get my nephew on, kind of bumping it up.
Just bidding with Monopoly money. Just
bidding with five people. I couldn't see who they were. The estate agent wasn't even involved. That's
is one of these ones where you like log in
it's
and you
just
have to,
online.
Yeah,
but you don't have to prove you have actually the money.
But some of the estate agents will ask for your letter of offer. Did you come across that where they want to see your letter of offer and stuff?
One of them I did, but another one I didn't.
Wow.
So I'm like, that's a bit spooky.
It seems like it's a bit of
a wild west at the moment.
I came across one time an auctioneer who wanted you to provide a letter of offer and loads of your bank statements to even go and see the house.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's actually quite common now. I think that's quite common. Just in the fact you rose about asking prices and how much higher they go, there's actually new stats on that houses are being sold for 4.6% over the original asking price in early 2024. That's compared to just 1% of a difference a year ago. Mm. So it's multiples of what that is.
Yeah.
There's so much talk now, obviously, in the political sphere about housing. Everyone's, you know, attuned to what's been happening in housing for the last number of years. You see a young person of our generation now is now the Taoiseach. He says he's going to fix it all. He has his ear to the ground. Yeah. He understands all of our age group's concerns. Are you encouraged? Are you enthused by what you're hearing from Simon Harris?
Not really, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's the same kind of, for my whole life, it's that government, really, yeah. I think. And even when, you know, it just seems like it's the same flavour of politician the whole time. And if they haven't solved it now, why do I trust them to solve it in a couple of months or a year or two? So I would be very pro new blood change, whatever that means. But no, I'm not filled with confidence, to be honest.
Wow. So you don't think it's going to make it, having a younger teacher, you don't think it's going to be the change we need?
No, I don't. No,
how
I
do
don't
all of your the friends that you grew up around in Churchtown, how do they feel about the flexibility that you have being able to move down the country and the idea they might see a lot less of you and that you're going to be pursuing this kind of very rural lifestyle that they're not used to?
Well, anytime I've told a friend or someone I know, they look at me like I've 10 heads, that I want to live down the country. They don't see it. But then they're like, I'm showing them photos of the houses I'm looking at and telling them the kind of way of life. And they're like, actually, that looks gorgeous. Yeah. Maybe I would like that. And I guess, you know, since the pandemic, a lot of my friends are only needed in the office twice a week.
Yeah.
I'm lucky in the sense I only need to be in Dublin really at something maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks. So the options are becoming more for people who maybe, you know, work half in Dublin and could live down the country. Mm. So I think people are, which is sad as well for the city, you know, but there's more options, I think.
But it must be heartbreaking then for your friends as well who don't have that luxury or who the nature of their work means that they can't work from home or that they have to be so city oriented that they look at what the quality of life you might be able to afford with the mortgage you've got if you're an hour and a bit down the road versus what they have to pay for a fraction of that or basically living in a shoebox.
Yeah. And as I said, the mortgage I was able to get, I couldn't afford. Maybe I could afford a studio apartment somewhere. Like that's even around my area in Phibsborough. Like the average house is like...
For like 350,000 euro though. Like let's be honest, 350,000 euro is over a quarter of a million euro. Like it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And to think that you were like so limited in your choices in Dublin is...
Yeah. And I adore Dublin. I really do. But it doesn't deserve to be that expensive. It really doesn't, in my opinion.
I mean, it's nice for you on a personal level that you'll have your family base in Dublin and you'll still be able to kind of come and stay a night and not have it cost you a couple of hundred euro.
I'm one of
like
the
that.
Lucky ones, you know, and I have friends who have houses around Dublin, like a couple of friends, and they have a couch I can sleep on or whatever if needs be, and I can actually I have the luxury of being able to live down the country, and not many people do, so I'm definitely one of the lucky ones. But yeah, I wouldn't like to be.
Sometimes we hear, you know, I know Leo Varadkar was one who would often talk about when people would, you know, choose to move abroad or live abroad that, oh, you know, young people want to travel. And that's totally fair. But do you see it in your circles and in your friend groups that people are now looking at living abroad as an option because it's necessity now?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who are in Australia in the health sphere.
Yeah. We've talked about that a lot on the podcast.
Yeah, and I'd say I've five nurses and maybe a doctor who live in Australia. The pay is better, the quality of life is better. So that was a necessity. Would they have moved if the pay was better here and they could afford a house? Probably they would have stayed. So yeah, I've a lot of friends who are living abroad who actually would prefer to live in Ireland, but. Mm.
But if they're working in the health sphere, you can't always trust there's going to be a hospital that specialises in their area in whatever Midlands or rural place they might be living in that you might be looking at.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, James, because some of the places that you went to see were like literally derelict buildings that had, you know, sort of like one of them last week they went to, they had to like climb their way in over a ditch to get in to see this place. Where was that again? It was in Cork.
Cork, yeah.
Yeah.
But the estate agent couldn't even get like the ditch mowed down for you.
No, it was €80,000 for this property though. Now, don't get me wrong, it could have been fab, right? It could have been fab. But realistically, even just when we talk about the cost of materials, that came up a lot in the show, didn't it? The cost of renovation and materials and how was it they had doubled maybe in like the last 5 years or something.
Yeah, this woman, I think she's in her 80s, called Mary Machete, and she had a machete in her boot and she was hacking her way through this forest being like, oh, it's beautiful here now, isn't it?
It was a kilometre in.
It was a kilometre in the hill.
Real track, yeah.
Now, I was kind of like, this is beautiful. There was a little river going through the property and stuff.
I felt
like,
for the camera
gorgeous.
Person loading the crew through there.
But she was saying, it was a shell. I mean, there was things grown out of the chimney and stuff. Like it was 80 grand.
It was a pile of stones, effectively.
Pile of stones, yeah. But she was saying, oh, you know, if you add another 500 or 400 onto that, then you could do it up. But from chatting to people who have just done renovations or made their house air to water or one of these kind of things, solar power and stuff, the price of materials themselves have doubled. Yeah. Mm. The price of labour as well has doubled. So I don't know. Like, I don't know when the good time is to do this stuff because it just seems like it's nose bleeding at the moment.
We'll see how it all goes anyway. The final episode is this Sunday night, 8 p.m. on Virgin Media One. Previous episodes are all on the player. And who knows what other tropical rainforests you'll have to hack your way through when you get
Hopefully
there.
Hopefully more.
James Cameron, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
Thanks for coming on, James. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Maybe the one bit of salient news that there actually was amid all the dull pomp and ceremony on Tuesday was a speech by Micheál Martin, who of course remains the Minister for Foreign Affairs, who had some announcements to make about some stance and action Ireland's going to be taking about the Middle East. Actually, let's take a listen.
We've agreed that the undermining of the Oslo Accords and therefore the agreement to create two states has reached a point where the Accords' approach of recognition after a final agreement is not credible or tenable any longer. I've discussed this with those in the region who are working on peace initiatives, and coordination with other countries continues intensively. We've discussed this between the government parties, and it is my intention to bring to government a formal proposal on recognition when these wider international discussions are complete. But be in no doubt, recognition of a Palestinian state will happen. Yeah. With others.
So statehood will be recognised. I have to admit, the second time that I heard that, it came across slightly stronger than the first time, because when I heard it in real time in the Dáil Chamber, it sounded like it was conditional on certain other stuff happening. Mm. Actually, when you hear it second time around, he's saying that, you know, we're not going to wait for some peace process to conclude before we recognise this. We're going to do it as part of trying to bring about peace, which is ostensibly a strengthening of our stance on this.
We only spoke about this last week.
Yeah. And now they're finally actually doing it. So they're not just waiting for Spain. Well, maybe they might do it.
Well, I think they are, really. Like, yeah, I think it's very much been instigated by Spain.
They might synchronise it with Spain. Yeah. But we're doing it. Mm. Which is quite significant.
Yeah. It is. It's a very significant thing because if you think back, I can remember years of discussion about when countries in Europe would actually go about recognising the state of Palestine. We, of course, have had Dáil votes on it previously as well. And now we do have the Taoiseach, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, effectively saying that Ireland as a state is going to do it within a matter of weeks is effectively where we're at now. And we will be joined by other European countries in doing that. Of course, we've talked previously about Spain being a big push factor in this. I was only chatting to Simon Harris for Virgin Media News at the weekend, and I was trying to get him to pin him down to sort of, you know, preempt this. If he's talking about it, and he had all that tough talk from the TikTok Taoiseach about Israel.
It's easy for you to say.
Really hard. Really hard. But he had all that talk about being repulsed by the actions of Benjamin Netanyahu in Gaza. And it was some of the strongest criticism of anybody in government.
He looked straight into the camera.
It was actually the only bit of his Ardèche speech that got a full house standing ovation. So, which
clip,
is interesting
and
from
the
Venezuela.
Clip that did the most rounds online.
Well, it's a fascinating area for Simon Harris because we know so little about his stance on international affairs because it's never been his beat until now.
Apart from, he did say a few months ago, I think he described it as a war on children.
Yes.
So that again was him sticking himself slightly further.
When he was taking leaders' questions because he was able to do it then.
There you go. But anyway, he was very much indicated this was going to happen. That this was going to be something which is going to be taken alongside, again, quote unquote, like-minded EU countries, and that this would be seen as, you know, giving more weight to actually pushing Israel into a peace-building moment. That if you treat the Palestine as it, you know, should be, as is accepted by international organisations and all these countries, that Palestine should be recognised as a state, it puts it on a par with Israel in an international standing, that Israel is forced to treat the Palestinian people as equals, that international organisations give it that heft behind it. Mm. And effectively, you force there to be some sort of a reckoning, a two-state solution at last. So it is a very significant thing. Some people have been critical that there wasn't a firm timeline put on it. Mary Lou McDonald, I think, was amongst them there. And then there's some activists as well who have been onto me about it saying, well, what gives? What gives anymore? This needs to be much more serious action taken by the West in terms of what's happening in Gaza rather than simply using words to recognise the state of Palestine.
So do you think there shouldn't have been an announcement before the announcement, that it just should have been... Like, you could argue the preamble, the anticipation of the announcement is helpful in some regards.
Probably is,
In some ways, but then you could also argue that in a way it nearly undermines the gesture when you do finally recognise statehood by announcing that you're going to do it but making it conditional on timing or whatever, that it kind of makes it seem like you do think of them as an equal in the international community but only at a certain point in the future.
Okay.
It's like that whole thing of whichever saint it was that was like, make me chase but not yet, that kind of thing. Mm.
There was a moment I had actually over the weekend. And it sort of makes you reckon with the humanity of these situations, because sometimes it can be very hard when you're just reading news headline, you're seeing clips on the news, and it's just, you know, figure after figure, it's desolation after desolation, and you lose that human connection to it. So I was in Ibrahim's house on Sunday evening. Was invited over for iftar, which is your Ramadan. Mm. Fast break for the evening. Mm. It's Eid as of day recording, the traditional end of Ramadan. And we're sitting around with his family. So that is the Alaga family, effectively. So it's his parents were there. His wife was there. His small children were there. And his wife's children, his parents were there as well. And we were just doing, as you sort of do at the end of a meal, you sit around, you flick on the television. And it was on that day that Israel pulled troops out of Khan Yunis. So camera crews and people were going back into Khan Yunis, which is the city where the Alagas were from. And imagine you... We're watching TV, as you do after dinner. Mm. You see your neighbourhood is on TV and you're like, geez, remember, it's the excitement of seeing your own home. Think about your estate, the street where you grew up on. And you know what exactly the blocks, this is exactly where you grew up. And you see all those houses are gone. All those blocks of flats completely gone. You can see the skies through the windows, effectively. And then imagine that one of the people who were sitting in the room was the head of, say, the Mater Hospital or the Bowmount Hospital. And then that hospital, which imagine the pride of, we were working the way through your career to build up, and you've been a doctor, a radiologist, blah, 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 you climb all the way around, you become the director of that hospital. Then the camera turns to that hospital and it's completely gone. It's completely gone. All you see is the facade of it. And he was just saying, this is Ibrahim's dad was the head of the director of that hospital in Khan Yunis, and it's just gone. Just completely, completely gutted. And it was just this awful silence of just watching this with people who knew everybody who was in the houses and the apartments around that building, mm. who had built their career up working to serve the people there and look after them. And it was just such an like astonishing moment of just like human connection to what's been happening there. And you replicate that then however many thousands of times across Gaza, however many different cities, however different townships in Gaza, and it becomes impossible to comprehend.
Did you feel being there with them when they had that moment where they casually turn on the telly and are reminded of the horror of the community that they used to live in? Did you feel like to them it was another sense of a penny dropping, or has the whole thing been so hammered home to them now that they're almost sort of detached from how horrible it looks?
Yeah, it's hard to, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth on it, but it was like, I think it was just, there was a sad acceptance because it was both like Ibrahim's dad and Ibrahim's, and Hamida, his wife's dad as well. They were just pointing out different buildings like, oh, I know where this person lived there. And all. Just weird experience to be through. But yeah, I think they've just, you've seen and heard everything. They're still worried about family members and loved ones there, as so many people are. And I just think they just, it was just such a weird and normal way of looking at the absolutely abnormal, the absolutely abject, the hunger, the starvation and the desolation of everything that you once knew.
I think as well, it's kind of a reminder that no matter how hopeful you are and how optimistic you are in the depths of that, that that dream or that ambition of eventually going home, knowing that home isn't what it used to be and that it's completely destroyed, changed. And if you do eventually one day get that chance to go home, that you have to start all over again and rebuild.
Yeah. I find it really hard to work on the psychology of that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Hearing it in a third person sense, that's the bit that strikes me most, that even if you have the aspiration of rebuilding everything, trying to salvage some sort of life from the ruins of what's left behind and reconstruct and rebuild and try to get back and living on, but the sense of community that you'll never get back, that you're so used to these people being your neighbours and this being your working life and you running this hospital and you running that hospital, you running this shop, you visiting this bakery, and that no matter whether you put the buildings back together, that the life and the fabric of the existence that you knew is never coming back.
It was just a way to just think back. It was just like thinking, imagine this was Lahinch, or imagine it was, you know, Meath and Waterford. Whatever. I'd ask people at home to probably think about that, just because it is very difficult sometimes, because there are so many catastrophes around the world. It's very difficult to sort of almost put yourself into that. Just imagine seeing your hometown, your home village just completely shattered and not a single living thing there, apart from, you know, people who are just dragging themselves back in there now that the Israeli military has left the area, and just rubble, pure rubble and dark skies.
So I just wanted to bring you an update. Well, there is no update as such on the Stardust inquest, because I know a lot of people are following it very closely. It's day six of deliberations, still no verdict. The jury are continuing to consider the five verdicts as we outlined last week that were put forward by the coroner. It's been a long couple of days. I've been over there myself for a few of the days, and families are just still waiting to find out what will happen. But yeah, there's really very little I can say, to be honest. You know, we've sat through kind of the few days of the deliberations, and you're probably not even seeing it on the news because there's nothing to report literally at the moment. But as soon as we do get that verdict, of course, we'll bring it to you.
I actually can't imagine the tension for them now, having waited so long for the inquest and now getting to this point that you're finally at that finish line, but you don't know what the outcome is going to be. I actually can't imagine how much on tenterhooks they must be. So we're
thinking of the family members are saying to me, like, you know, it's hard to sleep at night now at this
point. Absolutely.
They're really into that final stage. But anyway, as soon as we get it, of course, we'll bring
Yeah, of course. Of course, since the last time we all sat down together, we've had another batch of weather warnings, and they've now been and gone, and people will debate whether they were merited or how severe it was. You were in Galway for the weekend, obviously, so you caught some of the worst of it when you were knocking around University of Galway for the Ardèche weekend.
Most of it was inside for the Ardèche, yeah.
Luckily enough, anyway. One thing which I thought was remarkable, though, about the weather, because people sometimes see weather as being an isolated thing for a weekend, don't kind of see it as a season, that because the season has been so rainy so far, that basically there hasn't been a good dry patch where you can do a lot of agricultural work. Mm. I saw a stat last week that ordinarily by this time of year, there will be 21,000 acres of potatoes planted for harvesting for later in the year. And the weather has been so bad that they reckon only about 50 acres nationwide have been planted at this point, which presumably means at some point further into the year, either we're going to be massively reliant on imported potatoes, or you're going to be paying a whack more for a sack of spuds than you have been up till now.
Potentially so. And it is because, and I don't think anybody, particularly on the East Coast now, because the East Coast has gotten the worst of this rain. It's about 219%, so basically double your average March rainfall for last month along the East Coast. So if you think about where potatoes are mostly grown in this country, you go from Wexford all the way up through North County, Dublin, etc., into Meath as well. It's a very, very difficult time. And this is actually going to be one of the things which Simon Harris actually did say that he would look at in terms of actual policy. Here's what we're going to look at is relief packages for farmers, because we've talked for many years about various different challenges in farming. This one is out of the blue and it has left a huge, huge, huge impact, because East Coast, very difficult to plant, especially if we end up with a summer where there's more drought, which we have had multiple times in recent years. So that becomes really, really difficult, very, very expensive. On the West Coast side, more bad weather. There has been significant bad weather there. You've cows in sheds, you're feeding them expensive feed, silage-based feed. You can't get them out of the sheds yet. It's very, very tough. So I think it's probably something to keep a monitor on in terms of what the reliefs are, which are going to be offered. Which actually, interestingly enough, Pascal Donoghue, a couple of days before the transition of power, was like, no, we haven't got anything specifically lined up. And then fast forward 2 days, yeah we're going to do that.
Suddenly you realize you have
because
to post,
reality bites. But this is a very difficult situation for farmers across the country, and it's something which it does require careful monitoring.
And of course, we're only 2 months away from European elections, and so much of European elections is about agriculture policy and how things are funded. So it was going to come up then anyway, so the government might as well get out ahead of it. Did we all get a chance to listen to Cowboy Carter?
Yes,
sure did. Yeah.
We did.
Thoughts? Finally got all the way through it, actually.
Have you got a take?
I didn't get all the way through it, actually. So
it is too long.
It's really long.
It is too long.
There's the thing. I remember saying last week, is it not just the length of a double album, but actually, no, Modern Attention Spans, it is too long, isn't it?
I'm just looking actually on my Spotify. I think I actually have two songs left to get through. No, three.
That's pretty decent. That's the hour broken here.
On the theme of like maybe being too long, that it's almost like an indulgence on the part of the artist. And I know we could easily get crucified now for like
playing with fire, Gavin Riley.
Like the beehive is going to be right at me now for this one. I thought in particular, much as Beyonce is brilliant and has a Midas touch in almost everything she does, like, is Jolene not so iconic that you just have to leave it alone?
No,
I don't. I don't
think I don't really can reimagine it or reconceive.
Completely wrong.
No, you're wrong.
Because I think artists, and I get the point. I think if you're doing a song and you're doing a cover of a big famous song, the worst thing I think you can do is do a really faithful cover and just do it completely note perfect, pitch perfect, the same.
Yeah, no, you can't just
reinvention,
replicate it,
modernizing it. I think this was brilliant.
Oh,
this
the
was
best
great.
Part of it was when Dolly Parton comes on the start of it, though, and like has a little talkie bit at the start of it.
Yeah,
I think it's really good.
What did you think then, in along the lines of covers? Because Blackbird was the initial talking point of the album, of its resonance with civil rights in America and the way that she used it as a launch pad for other Black country artists. So that was quite clever.
I thought it was quite clever, but I sometimes worry that you need to have done too much prior reading before you can fully take in the significance of that, because I know there'll be some people who will hear her doing Blackbird and not understand its kind of place in social history in the part of the world that she grew up in, and just think you've just done a Beatles cover, and will not think that it's a particularly fabulous Beatles cover.
What is wrong with you? It was such a good cover. No, I totally disagree with you. I mean, listen, hang on a second now.
Let's beat up Gavin Riley on this segment of the podcast.
I just need you to come back to reality for a minute now, Gavin. Just join us here. And you didn't think Beyonce's version of Blackbird was good?
I wanted a bit.
I'm
probably at that old fogey thing now where I'm kind of too set in my ways, where I only like the original version that I already know and I can't really get to grips with a new one.
But like, okay, even if you leave aside that people don't, you know, didn't need the whole backstory or didn't read the whole backstory, you're asking a lot of them. The way that it's, people access this on Spotify or whatever, and they have all of the individual artists who featured on that, it just opens their careers up to a huge, huge exposure.
I don't doubt at all that it's a great springboard for them. I just...
Some great tracks in there. Awesome. I do stand by my criticism of this album that it's way too long. And I saw some tweet the other day somebody quote tweeted Michelle Obama saying that the reaction to this album has been Stalinist in terms of this is huge praise for something which is, you know, good, but not the best album.
My final point would just be listen to it all in a row, though.
I think you need to
do it that way, yeah.
We'll be back same time next week. Well, I won't be back because I'll have been killed by the beehive, but they'll be back next week and I'll be here if I'm still alive. Till then, thanks for joining us. See you next week.
Thanks,
bye.
Everybody.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.